Leading Ideas Talks is brought to you by the Lewis Center for Church Leadership of Wesley Theological Seminary in Washington, D.C. Subscribe free to our weekly newsletter at www.churchleadership.com/leading ideas. How can white Christians talk faithfully about racism? In this episode, Carolyn Helsel discusses her new book, Anxious to Talk About It, with Lewis Center Associate Director Ann Michael.
I'm Ann Michael, Associate Director of the Lewis Center for Church Leadership of Wesley Theological Seminary in Washington, D.C. I'm also the editor of Leading Ideas e-newsletter, and I'm pleased to be the host of this Leading Ideas Talks podcast, in which we're going to be talking with Carolyn Helsel, who is the author of the book Anxious to Talk About It, Helping White Christians Talk Faithfully About Racism. Carolyn is a PCUSA minister, and she teaches preaching at Austin Presbyterian Theological Seminary in Austin, Texas. So welcome to you, Carolyn.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I know that your book grew out of work that you've done over many years with congregations and church groups on this subject of racism. Can you say a few words about the experience that you bring to the subject?
Sure. It came originally out of my own sense of deep dissonance, feeling that as a Christian who'd grown up in the church, who had been preparing for ministry since I was 15, to have all of a sudden in seminary realize there's this whole world that I couldn't even see, I didn't even know, and yet this pain that is part of this reality of racism is something that I'm deeply implicated in. And how, as a Christian, can I respond in my own life and my own faith journey? But then also, as a person preparing for ministry, how can I help others that I will be serving have these kinds of conversations well also? I'd been part of diversity trainings and other kind of multicultural events during my education and since. And often I kind of felt like I was never that expert. I was never the kind of person who could stand up in front of those groups and do those kinds of presentations, because often I felt really inadequate after them and felt a lot of shame, some guilt, and felt like, I wonder if there's another way of doing this to help people not immediately go to those places of shame and guilt. How can I do this in a way that's perhaps more sustainable in the long run? Because I knew my own tendency was to kind of want to shut down. So in learning about this after seminary, through my ministry experiences on the U.S.-Mexico border in a church in San Antonio, and then working in administration and seminary admissions back at the seminary where I did my MDiv, this question kept coming up. How do I talk about racism with other white people when I see a lot of anxiety around the subject? And it was then that I discovered Racial Identity Development by Beverly Daniel Tatum and Janet Helms. And that theory really kind of helped me sit with some of the different changes that I saw in my own life and the kind of emotional resistances that I saw not only in myself, but in others. So I went on to do a PhD to try to understand that more and to understand it from different perspectives. And after that, as I continued to work with churches and other groups who knew that my research was in helping white people talk about racism, found again and again this kind of affirmation that people were needing some other way to kind of get at this subject in a way that didn't automatically lead to feelings of inadequacy, shame, and guilt.
Mm-hmm. Well, that really gets at the next question that I wanted to ask you. Since the book is written explicitly to it's written by a white person to an audience of white people. And I was wondering if you could explain why you felt it was important to come at the subject from that particular angle.
Yeah, well, naming myself as a white person was often kind of the initial breakthrough that I needed to say that I'm not just a generic universal American that I'd grown up to see myself as. I was a racialized person, racialized as white, which gave me unfair advantages. And how can I, who don't experience racial discrimination, speak about this subject? And again, I saw not only in things that I was reading, but in conversations with people, that people of color were saying, you know, we don't want to be the constant educators for white people. We need white people to do their own work mm-hmm. and to help other white people understand this subject, because we're tired of living with racism, you know, let alone having to do the additional hard work of dealing with white people's feelings and education around this subject. So it felt as if, okay, I am a white person and I'm uniquely gifted to be able to have some of these conversations with the people who look like me. But after the book has come out, as I've been part of a lot of multicultural, multiracial spaces of people who have been doing this in Bible studies or small groups, people of color have been saying, you know, this has been something I needed to hear too. This has been something that's been helpful for me as well. So that's been really, really satisfying for me to hear that even though I'm trying to help white people because I feel that they, from my own experience, lack the most knowledge about this, I'm hearing people of color also say, no, the things that you're writing about are also pertinent to us and that we need to hear also. And
so the book is also written to a Christian audience. And I was interested in hearing you speak to, I mean, I know this topic of race is relevant in so many sectors of our society. There are certainly conversations going on within academia and education and in the workplace and in our political dialogue. And yet this book is for a Christian audience. And I wondered what you think, in what ways do you think the conversation is different in the church?
Well, on a very basic level, the demographics of the church continue to be one of the most racially segregated spaces in our society. We may have workplaces that are diverse. We may have school settings that are more diverse. But by and large, we worship in racially segregated spaces. And at the heart of a lot of the Christian movement throughout the United States, there was this real segregation that was part of early Christian movements, and the ways that different churches got started was often because white churches were kicking out the people of color in their midst and not allowing them to be in the pews there alongside them. So there really seems to be this need to address it where we've had this Christian deformation of our spiritual life, of our spiritual imagination of being able to see who is my neighbor. And so I feel that there's a particular need within Christianity for us to consider this, but also because as a Christian, I feel that my faith has helped me to walk through this process in a way that helps me remember that God is still working in me. God is still working in this world. And that kind of affirmation that brings me hope is something that sustained me in this work.
Are there ways in which the church's history and tradition help?
Yes, help
the conversation?
Definitely. Mm-hmm. Yes. The fact that one of our central sacraments is this meal around a table, that image, that ritual, that sacrament that is so holy to us of Christ's body broken and blood shed for us is also a way of us understanding the common meal as a place of our own experiences of eye opening, our eyes being opened and having conversation with others. So having that be part of our worship, but also the fact that most churches like food, you know, we like to eat together. we like to put out refreshments after worship. And that kind of habit of being together allows for a type of fellowship and a laying down of our defenses that can often make these kinds of conversations possible. The fact that people are already in small groups in a lot of churches means that they're in these intimate relationships with other people, in these deeper kinds of connections that allow for this kind of truth-telling and honesty to say, wow, I'd never thought of it that way. Like, wow, that was your experience. Oh my goodness. And to have those kinds of honest sharing where people feel that they're already in some sort of relationship that's strong enough to carry them when they make mistakes and when they acknowledge their imperfections. And so most definitely, the church has a lot of resources for helping us address this.
Yeah, so also, the church offers kind of the relational container. It's a place of trust and intimacy where this kind of conversation can occur in a meaningful way.
Yes, yes. And not only that, our theological themes of human brokenness, the fact that we confess our sins every week. I mean, where else do you do that in, you know, the corporate world? Like, people don't admit mistakes. You know, people don't say, I am wrong, you know, please forgive me. In the law, in the justice system, that's often not what we see happening. But every week in worship, every week we have people saying, you know, God, forgive me for I've sinned. You know, that this regular confession of sin makes the Christian church a unique place to be able to say, we acknowledge that we're not getting this right, that humanity is broken as a whole, and we as individuals, and we're seeking redemption, we're seeking salvation. So the very posture of confession and praying that God will forgive us and help redeem us, I think all of that, again, makes Christian churches great places for us to be able to have these kinds of conversations.
Well, in the book, you also touch on another piece of our theology that you suggest as a framework for conversation about race, and that's gratitude. Can you explain how you see gratitude as a key element of the conversation?
Yes. And this varies from Christian denominations. So I acknowledge I'm coming from a very particular, Reformed tradition. But I didn't grow up hearing a lot of sin talk or shaming from the pulpit or ways of making me feel bad as a motivator for helping me to do good. Rather, the idea behind our faith is that we are called to live differently out of the gratitude that we feel for God's grace, that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us, that we are not earning our salvation. It's not a works-based religion, that it's something that we feel has been given to us by God's grace. And so that rooting in gratitude for me helps these discussions primarily because as a white person, I'm always going to be getting it wrong. I'm always going to be making mistakes. As someone who's still living in this, you know, racially segregated society, I'm going to make mistakes. And so not letting myself beat myself up about those mistakes, but to say, okay, I am living out of a gratitude that somehow I know God is still working in this world and in me and in others, and letting that gratitude be what motivates me. I find that to be a much more long-term, sustaining root motivator for me in this work.
Mm-hmm. One of the other attitudes that I think is front and center in the book is in the title, where you say anxious to talk about it. You talk about anxiety as being one of the realities that's part of this conversation about race. Do you want to speak a little bit to why you chose that particular term and how you see that connected to faithful conversation around race?
Yeah. So for many years, I didn't hear about racism because there was a silence in the church about it. And there was also kind of a growing cultural idea behind the value of color blindness. And if people didn't talk about race and racism, then it would just go away. But the fact that there were so many ways that we just didn't know how to talk about it, that sense of kind of cultural ineptness, that we weren't going to get it right, even if we tried, led to a lot of anxiety and continues to on behalf of people who worry that they're not politically correct, that they don't know the right terms. And so rather than it just being about we are wanting to be silent because we're kind of intentionally wanting to ignore this problem, I think a lot of silence has to do with this anxiety of not knowing what to say, how to say it, the fear of being accused of being a racist. But there's a lot of anxiety around the feelings that come up with these conversations. People are anxious about hearing other people's deep pain and anger and frustration. And maybe they're anxious and fearful about feeling their own feelings around this subject. And so a lot of those emotions, that fear, that anxiety, can create these mental barriers for us. We want to kind of shut down. We want to kind of withdraw. We want to put ourselves in a space of distance from these conversations. And all of that is not conducive, you know, to having deep, intimate conversations where we can grow. So one of my main goals has been to try to decrease that anxiety for people, to try to help particularly white people not feel that fear, that anxiety, but to rather embrace these conversations through this lens of gratitude, in the sense that, you know, sometimes you receive a gift that is going to make you grow, and it may not feel like a good gift to you at first, but anticipating that there will be some moment in the future where I'll feel grateful, where I am so glad that I did this, that I had this conversation, that I engaged in this kind of work, and trusting that that gratitude will come sometime in the end, I think helps us to kind of put our amygdala, that part of the brain that does the fight and flight, it just kind of puts that in check and says, you know, you don't have to worry right now. It's going to be okay. Eventually, there's going to be some good that comes out of this.
Mm-hmm. You've just talked about the emotional dimension of this subject, and that's really a subtext, I think, running through your book is the prominence of emotion in how people regard and talk about issues of race, and also the importance of story and narrative in terms of how we communicate authentically about race. Knowing that those two factors, emotion and story, are so real in this conversation, I wondered if you had any concrete suggestions for congregations on how they could structure conversations in a way that acknowledges the importance of emotion and story, and perhaps uses them in positive ways to promote this dialogue.
Just to be able to say, I see what you're going through, can mean a world of difference in these kinds of conversations. And so modeling that sense of being able to share hard stories in which people aren't being asked to be to fix it or to say that I did this or that, but sharing stories in a way that says, this is a deep pain, and I need you to look at it and not look away, I think is a way of modeling this for these kinds of conversations. Because it's often when people share something that's been very painful or has a lot of emotional content in the story that we tend to get uncomfortable. We tend to not know how to respond. So encouraging people to consider, how can you respond? What are some ways that you can respond in this moment that acknowledges that this person is going through significant pain and has had a really difficult experience?
Do you know some exercises or ways of starting people down this path of sharing their stories? I mean, how do you invite people into that place within within an intimate congregational setting?
So, for instance, I'm doing a weekly series at a church here in Austin where Sunday afternoons I've been meeting with them for, I will at the end, for 6 weeks. And the first time that we met together, I really wanted to highlight the role of our emotions in our bodies and how it's important for us to kind of pay attention to where that emotion is in our bodies so that we can be present to it. It's easy for us to go into defense mode when we are all in our head and are worried about what we're thinking. Whereas I encourage us to just think, what are we feeling in our bodies? I passed out index cards to people that had already been divided randomly into small groups. And I invited them first to sit down in their small groups without having said a word. And in those small groups to sit quietly for a moment with no one talking and just to think about, where am I feeling my feelings right now? Where in my body am I feeling it? And what's the one word I would use to describe that feeling? And then after kind of a few minutes have passed, I invite the people in the small group to go around and name that one word. And once they've named that one word of that feeling, I invite them to share more. You know, can you tell me more about that feeling, where that feeling comes from, why you feel that way? And then on these little index cards that I've handed out, one index card, a pen, something really simple, I invite them to draw a stick figure drawing of an incident that they remember that deals with race or racism. So they draw a stick figure drawing that kind of represents a whole story. Then I invite them to, again, thinking about emotions, write the emotion that's associated with that story. So they write the emotion words on that card. And then I invite them after our time is kind of coming to a close and people have had a chance to talk with one another about their stories, to place their hand on that index card and to place their hand over those feeling words and to say a prayer over those words and over those feelings and over that story and to remember that God was present with them in that moment and God is present with them now. God sees those emotions and feelings and God is in those feelings as well. Then as we close, I invite people to come to the front where we've had a communion table and they lay that card on the table like it is an offering as a way of saying, here, we are offering these stories up to God. And that's just kind of one introductory way of bringing people into this space to say, we have a lot of different stories and we come with a lot of different feelings to this event. And yet God is with each of us individually, as well as us together. And week after week, we kind of build on those connections so that we can feel that, yes, we're all in this for a reason, because we feel God has called us to deeper community, and we're ready for that. We want to go there.
Mm-hmm. And so this is within the context of a primarily white congregation.
Yes, but you know, for instance, even with this local church, there's a lot of people of color who are present in this congregation too, who show up every week. This past Sunday, one of the women there who had been coming several every week so far, and who had always been quiet and her face was hard to read, African American woman. Hadn't tried to really engage her because I don't want to put people of color on the spot in these spaces. This past Sunday, she comes up to me and she said, you know, after reading this chapter, we had been covering chapter 4 on listening to other stories of race. She said, I really felt something. Hearing these stories in this chapter really made me feel something. And I just want to say thank you. Thank you for writing this book, and thank you for even caring. And it was one of those moments, again, that I don't try to seek out, because I don't want to turn to people of color as a way of kind of validating my work or to say, you know, please help me feel good as a white person. But the fact that she in this space with other white people and other people of color was feeling a sense of being heard, of being able to connect to her own feelings, of being able to hear other stories, was really deeply, deeply satisfying for me.
So if I were a pastor or a Christian educator or a social justice coordinator within my congregation, and I wanted to begin to initiate a conversation around race within my congregation, what are the first steps that you would recommend? Is this something that begins in the pulpit, or does it begin with education and awareness building, or does it begin in small groups? I mean, how do you lay the groundwork for beginning this journey?
I think it can begin in the pulpit. It can begin a number of different places, but in the pulpit is where a preacher can signal to others in the congregation that this is something that I, as your leader, am willing to embrace and talk about. And then that's when you hear from people that are already present to say, yes, thank you. I want to talk about this too. And I want to help lead a group, or I think this is something that we could be doing. You know, it's always amazing the kind of resources that are already present in a congregation. So I don't have a blueprint of plans for churches to follow, because I think each location, each particular congregation is unique and has its own needs. But I encourage that sense of particularity of saying, as a congregation, where are we? What have been the stories in our area that have mostly impacted this community, part of the world, stories that have to do with race and racism? What are the stories present in our congregation? What are the resources available? Who might already be working on this in an upcoming book that I have that's going to be published December 5th, out again through Chalice Press, on preaching about racism, a guide for faith leaders. I talk a little bit about suggestions for churches of where to go, but I also give a lot of suggestions for preachers, because I think it really can initially start in the pulpit with preachers naming this. But for people in the pews, they, you know, talking about systems may not really connect with them because of their own stories about race. They may particularly see it in particular acts of intentional harm, of, you know, racist discrimination or Ku Klux Klan rallies, or saying the N-word. Helping listeners to kind of get a sense through other stories about race that can help them get a grasp of what we're talking about, rather than just definitions, learning through stories and through emotions to help get a sense of the bigness of the kind of radical notion of racism still being very alive and well and embedded in a lot of everyday interactions and institutions that we're part of. So helping pastors and preachers and faith leaders kind of unpack that notion.
Mm-hmm. So I think I'm hearing you say that this is deeply contextual work, but that, you know, just as the church is uniquely suited to providing the relational space for this conversation, perhaps the platform of the pulpit, with the ability to use the dimensions of narrative and emotion in the way that we communicate, is another sort of unique avenue that the church has to further this discussion.
Yes, yes. The way that preaching can really rely on narrative and really draw on the feelings, as well as in the narratives of our scriptures. I mean, there are so many stories of persons who are treated unfairly, treated unjustly, and how do we lift up some of the scriptures that we're preaching on as mirrors of today? Sometimes, justice isn't done in some of the texts that we're reading. And so how do we name those incidents that happen today where justice is not done also? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of ways of also naming race and racism through the language of sin, through some of these theological concepts and metaphors that help us really understand, again, the depth of the problem. So I have a chapter on speaking theologically about race and racism through these metaphors of embodiment or bondage and estrangement and idolatry. So I'll start with that first one, the embodied notion of race and racism that leads to this sense of bondage. You know, bondage is something that we talk about in Scripture, being a slave to sin. But in the light of the history of racism and slavery in this country, what sense does it make to talk about it as bondage today? And I say that for white people, there's still these embodied habits of fear where women will clutch their purse in an elevator when white women are in an elevator with a black person. And this embodied response that may not even be conscious, may not be intentional. And so that's kind of some of the ways that I think it's helpful for us to understand, again, the depth of this problem, this bondage to sin, and for persons of color who experience their very bodies inscribed with meanings by our society, whose very bodies suggest that they are a threat. Again, that's kind of the embodied, the bondage of sin that's still on people's bodies as a result of the sin of racism.
Mm-hmm. Well, I certainly look forward to that next book. I think it's wonderful to know that you're continuing this work and thinking about this in theological categories and ways that might help preachers in terms of their task. And that actually brings me to the final question that I wanted to ask you, and that's this. I think particularly since Ferguson, we here at Wesley Seminary have paid a lot more attention to equipping our students to be in community dialogue around issues of race, to being engaged in forms of community activism. And yet I have been painfully aware of how few really good resources there are for the church world on this whole spectrum of issues related to race and racial conversation. I wonder if there are any other resources that you would want to lift up or highlight for people that are wanting to take this on.
Well, one of the great resources that that I've been reading recently is Fearless Dialogues by Greg Ellison. He's a pastor of pastoral care, a professor of pastoral care at Candler Seminary in Atlanta. And his book is an excellent way of understanding how we can have these conversations, again, not devoid of fear, but fearing less, having less fear, not saying that this we don't have any reason to fear, but to try to approach these conversations with less fear. Of course, my upcoming book, Preaching About Racism, A Guide for Faith Leaders, I hope will be of great help. But as well as all of the novels and resources that are coming out for a broader audience, Austin Channing Brown's book, I'm Still Here, a personal kind of look at as a Black woman growing up in white communities, what that was like for her. The creators of the kind of the Black Lives Matter hashtag writing this book called When They Call You a Terrorist, you know, all of these kinds of ways of, again, narratively entering this conversation, I think can help people take those next steps of saying, okay, what are the stories that we need to be listening to in our own area, in our own communities? And how can those stories and the resources that we have here in our area inspire us to be involved and to join in what other people are already doing.
Mm-hmm. And I know in your current book, you at the back of the book even mention popular movies and other things that, you know, everyday people might be familiar with that can be helpful springboards to conversation. And so
yes,
it's not all in the academic sphere where we're finding ways to prod people's thinking on this issue. So
right. Yeah, there's a lot of great movies these days that can really help us have these conversations too.
Mm-hmm. Well, Carolyn, I want to thank you for talking with us today. I want to thank you for taking on this important subject and for guiding people in the church in how we can come at it in a more faithful and authentic way. Thanks for taking time to talk to us, and I wish you the best of luck as this new book comes to press. We'll certainly be looking forward to that as well.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Leading Ideas Talks has been brought to you by the new Welcome Video Toolkit. Learn concepts and strategies to welcome and respond to your first time and repeat visitors, reach younger generations, expand your church's entry points, and get new people involved. The new welcome is available on download and DVD at churchleadership.com/new welcome. On our next episode of Leading Ideas Talks, Lewis Center Director Douglas Poe discusses biblical leadership with thought leader Dr. Denise Domkowski Hopkins, the Woodrow W. and Mildred B. Miller Professor of Biblical Theology at Wesley Theological Seminary in Washington, D.C.
I love Moses because Moses lifts up an aspect of leadership that I think is crucial to any good leader, and that is Moses exhibits the quality of chutzpah. And chutzpah in Jewish tradition is basically boldness with regard to God for the sake of justice and community. Chutzpah is getting in God's face over issues that matter in the community. So, for example, Moses argues with God, blames God. When the taskmasters increase the slaves' burden in Egypt by saying, you want to go away for 3 days and worship God? Oh, no, you're not doing that. In fact, now you will continue to meet your brick quota, but now you must gather your own straw in order to make the bricks, whereas before we had provided it. The slaves and their overseers, of course, complain to Moses, and then Moses complains to God and says, you haven't done a thing to help these people. In fact, you've made it worse. And most leaders, I find, come into class and tiptoe around their relationship with God and repress the kind of anger and questioning they feel in terms of what they encounter in their ministry. And they are very hesitant to wrestle with God over what's happening.
Leading Ideas Talks is available on iTunes, the Google Play Store, and Stitcher. Subscribe today. Thank you for joining us. And don't forget to subscribe free to Leading Ideas at churchleadership.com/leadingideas.